Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest tells us how authoritarian leaders come to power in democratic countries and what we can learn to prevent other strongmen from taking control in the future. First, President Biden has signed more than 30 executive actions during his first week in office aimed at preserving the DACA program, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, and more. Executive orders and other actions were also used by Presidents Obama and Trump. Both were criticized by some members of Congress for trying to create policy without input from the legislature. Our next guest says that while executive orders are a powerful tool, they have limits that can act as their own kind of check on a president's vision. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about what a president can and can't do through different kinds of executive action? Does it bother you when a president tries to implement policy through executive orders? Or are you glad that it's an option, especially when Congress can't seem to compromise on a particular issue? And what do you think of what we've seen from President Biden with executive actions so far? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Rudlevich is a professor of government and the chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He's the author of several books, including the upcoming By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Andy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
I use the phrase executive order a lot. That's just part of the toolkit here, right? Can you tell us about the range of different executive options that a president can use without having to go to Congress?
Sure. Well, over time, as Congress, you mentioned this already, has gotten more gridlocked, presidents have turned to a whole toolbox of executive actions, we might call them. That includes executive orders. It includes proclamations, formal memoranda to different agency and department heads, could even include guidance documents that tell different agencies how they're supposed to interpret different regulations. And we might include those regulations themselves, right? When Congress passes a law, it usually gives a lot of discretion to the executive branch and how to implement it. And again, a president who wants to shape that has some tools for doing so.
We've seen high-profile executive actions of various sorts from President Obama, President Trump, now President Biden. Are they getting more common over the years, or are high-profile ones getting used more often, or is it just that we're noticing them more?
Well, I think we're certainly noticing them more, partly because that's where the action is, right? When Congress is unable to act, presidents have frequently sort of said, well, you know, as President Obama put it, I've got a pen and a phone. You know, we can't wait for Congress to act. President Trump said similar things. President Bush used to talk about how he could do things on his own if Congress was gridlocked. So we are certainly seeing that as a pretty prominent part of the president's program, especially in periods where Congress isn't acting. You know, in terms of pure numbers, they're probably not up dramatically. If you look back to the 1940s and at the list of executive orders that Franklin Roosevelt issued, for example, you know, he was issuing 300 or 400 orders a year, but many of them were very small bore. I mean, it used to be that to exempt somebody from mandatory retirement age, for example, in the entire federal government, the president had to issue an executive order. So those are no longer required in those kinds of cases. The executive orders we do see tend to be more substantively significant, and that's another reason we pay more attention to them.
We're talking about the executive powers of the president and its limits with Andrew Rudlevich. He's with Bowdoin College, and he's the author of the book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. Well, there's a big spoiler in your subtitle, Andy. There are limits. What are some of the boundaries that, you know, even if a president wanted to do more, they're kind of restrained here?
Well, there are two or three big ones. The biggest probably is that you can only act if you have previously been authorized to act by the Constitution directly or by statute in the past. So really, executive orders are exercising delegated power that Congress has already given the president. Now, the good news for presidents, I suppose, is that Congress has authorized quite a lot over the years. But nonetheless, presidents do have to be cognizant of how much discretion they have under the law. Another possible limit is procedural. Right, you actually have to justify what you're doing in a way that will allow, for example, a court to uphold your discretion under the law, especially with regulations. You know, if you don't follow the procedures laid out in law, then you may wind up in trouble. So, for example, you know, President Trump had tried to rescind DACA, the President Obama's initiative to allow the Dreamers, so-called, to stay in the United States. The court just this year refused to allow that to be rescinded because President Trump had not followed the proper procedure in justifying his action. So that's yet another limit. A third might be that the executive branch itself has a lot to say about how executive orders are crafted. They're unilateral in the sense that the president issues them, but very rarely, you know, do they come straight from the president's brain. The wider bureaucracy has a role both in formulating them and then, of course, in implementing them.
And what one president giveth, another can taketh away. How much do we see executive orders ping-ponging back and forth, say, between Democratic and Republican administrations?
Yeah, well, quite a lot. And we've seen that already in the first not quite a week of the Biden administration. You know, in a number of his executive orders are, you know, the revocation of Trump executive orders. And, you know, that's a quick way to send a message to your base. President Trump, of course, did the same thing with President Obama's orders. And President Obama, you know, took the opportunity in his first week to rescind a number of George Bush's orders. So there are, you know, some of these kind of travel throughout time. A Democrat comes in and automatically puts in a certain policy that's then reversed by a Republican. But many of them are, you know, aimed at sending a signal to your own base that, you know, you're different. You've been elected and you're going to change the way the policies are moving forward. You know, even if it's not going to happen very quickly, or even if it is more symbolic than substantive, right? To really make a substantive change to the Affordable Care Act, President Trump needed to try to repeal and replace it, which of course never happened. But he was able to send messages to his constituents that he was trying to do this by issuing various orders, trying to limit its reach.
As you mentioned, there have been some substantive executive actions in recent administrations. How much of that is coming from the difficulties in a president getting major legislation passed on hot button issues like, say, immigration along with Congress?
Yeah, I think quite a lot of it, to be honest. If you think about the growth of the federal government over, I don't know, almost 90 years now since the New Deal in the 1930s, you know, this growth of the administrative state, what critics often call the deep state, you know, that has built up a lot of administrative authority in the executive branch that a president can try to use to his advantage, right, in implementing his policy preferences. And then you also have the fact that Congress, of course, is subject to the partisan polarization that we see all around us. We've had divided government quite frequently. Hard to get things done. So you have all these old laws sitting around. And if you can't pass a new law, then maybe what you want to do as president is to come up with a new meaning for an old law. So you see kind of aggressive interpretations of what those laws mean, whether it's immigration law, environmental law, healthcare, education, right? So presidents are, have a big legal team on their side. And what they're doing in part is looking for ways to act without having to go back to Congress, just because it's so hard to get Congress to move proactively these days.
In some ways, this doesn't seem like the optimal way to be doing things, right? And this is kind of, I don't want to say broken, but a bit of a dysfunctional system if what you just laid out is turning into the normal practice. Am I wrong?
No, it makes a lot more sense, frankly, for Congress to revisit some of these issues, right? We haven't had the Clean Air Act, for example, was revised significantly in 1990, but that's, 30 years ago now. And, you know, if Congress wants to have a say about how, you know, environmental policy is carried out in this country, then it needs to revisit the ground rules that it passed 30 years ago, and in some cases, 50 years ago. You have, immigration legislation. When it came to the Supreme Court a couple of years ago, the travel ban case, Supreme Court looked at the Immigration and Nationality Act and said that it, quote, exuded deference, unquote, to the president. So President Trump said, hey, that's great. I can do more or less what I want in the field of immigration. And, but that's not really how the system is set up. Congress is Article 1 of the Constitution for a reason and really ought to be directing policy. That's a cleaner system. And it also, by the way, means that we're not relying on the courts to serve as the final arbitrators of what presidents can and can't do. That's not necessarily a court function to serve as a policy creator, and yet they are called into that role very frequently by, you know, the controversial nature of efforts by presidents to assert executive action.
We're talking to Andy Rudlevich right now, professor of government at Bowdoin College, about executive actions of various sorts, what the president can do with them, and their limits. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how recent presidents have used executive orders? If you supported President Trump or you support now President Biden, were there particular things they did through their own presidential authority that you were glad to see? Do you think it's gone too far? Do you want to see Congress step in some of these gray areas that leaves presidents wiggle room and define the laws a little better? And if so, what would you want to see? Are there particular things you'd like to see Congress work on and come to an agreement on somehow? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Andy Rudlevich, Chair of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College, looking at what presidents can and can't do with executive orders and other actions. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts about executive action, how much authority presidents do and don't have, whether you want to see President Biden be more or less aggressive with using them, and of course, your questions about how this all works. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Andy, as we mentioned, President Biden has a lot going on with his various executive actions. What stands out to you as maybe the most significant content-wise, policy-wise?
Well, again, so he has a bunch of actions that are trying to roll back different Trump-era actions and sort of return to the, you know, I guess it would be the Obama status quo. He's really focused on two or three main themes that he talked about in the campaign. Certainly COVID is one of them, right? Pandemic relief, that's been an important part. Now, the president, and this is a good example of, you know, the limits of executive action. You know, President Biden's White House has talked about a mask mandate. But, you know, and that, of course, is controversial, depending where you are in the country or in a given state. But, you know, the president does not have the power to impose a national mask mandate. That is limited if you look at his order to interstate commerce and travel, right? And, of course, to federal property. So, you know, sometimes the rhetoric runs a little ahead of the substance in these matters. But, you know, he's created a new testing board. He's trying to revamp the way that vaccines are produced and distributed. And so that could wind up being pretty important. A lot of what executive action often does is to reorganize the executive branch and to, we hope, make it more efficient. We'll see what happens there. He'd had an executive order relatedly telling OSHA, right, the Worker Health and Safety Office, to be a little more stringent in how it protected workers against infection from the pandemic. So, you know, that's one big area. We've seen, you know, others dealing with economic recovery. His very first executive order had to do with racial equity and ordering departments and agencies to try to do a better job on that front. So, you know, he's sort of making a down payment, at least on some of his campaign promises in those areas, you know, in conjunction, of course, with some very big legislative proposals that he hopes will get some attention.
Let's bring on a caller now. Gene is with us in Platteville. Gene, hi.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yep, go for it, Gene.
Okay, thank you. So I just made a couple, about 3 points. Okay, so going back in history just a little bit with Bush, he kind of was more of an agreement. I don't know if it had to do with his dad or not, but son Bush wanted to go to war. So he just kind of went toward that way, making that executive order. And then we had, and of course, President Trump, his more issue was more to actually be on the side of the billionaires and the corporations.
I'm going to jump in, Gene, because we just have a couple minutes left. Don't have time for all 3 points. I want to start there, though. She refers to George W. Bush and going to war. That was done with an authorization of use of force from Congress. That's been left with a lot of latitude since then, Andy. Can you talk about that part of a president's powers?
Yeah, well, the war powers would certainly be a whole nother conversation, because that's another area where Congress has really deferred a lot of power to the president. But in President Bush's case, right, of course, after the September 11th attacks, Congress did pass an authorization for the use of military force, which was very broad, delegated a lot of power to President Bush. And then the invasion of Iraq had a separate authorization in late 2002. So, you know, we can disagree with the way those were used, but they were authorized by Congress. One interesting thing, though, about both of them, they're still in effect, right? Many years after they were passed. And so, you know, the 2001 authorization, for example, has been used in using American force against ISIS. It's been used in Africa, right? In a bunch of places around the world that really have a very tenuous connection to September 11th. So, you know, this is yet another area, I think, where Congress should really be looking at taking back the war power, which, after all, is delegated to Congress in the Constitution.
Thanks for that call, Gene. We'll go to Jeff now in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi. During the campaign, Biden talked about codifying the Roe v. Wade law that Supreme Court decided years ago on the issue of abortion. I'm curious, with executive action, can Biden order a state to provide abortion services? Because I believe Missouri no longer has abortion clinics within their border. Or can the president order a state to no longer provide abortion services on that issue?
Jeff, thanks for the call. Andy?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And there's some interesting questions about federalism when it comes to presidential action, right? What powers does the national government have versus the states? Mostly what this federal government can do is either bribe or blackmail states to do something that it wants them to. And so in this case, you know, we saw it with President Trump seeking to withhold grant money, for example, from states, from cities that he thought were, you know, not handling, the protests against racial justice over the summer very well, or so-called sanctuary cities, right? So basically what you have is the ability of the federal government to manipulate how funding gets to the states. And there are some possibilities, right, where you could give incentives to states to provide more abortion services, for example, or fewer, where you could stop reimbursing different kinds of health providers, for example. But you do get into questions of how those laws are written, what the regulations require. And states have been pretty successful in fighting those kinds of restrictions in court.
Thanks for the call, Jeff, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Andrew Rudilevich from Bowdoin College about executive order and other presidential authority and the limits it has. Let's go to another caller now. Sarah is with us in Zion, Illinois. Sarah, hello.
Trying to get to the bottom of this thing that's going on with Mitch McConnell and Chuck Schumer right now, where Mitch McConnell is refusing to, well, they're not coming to an agreement about what the rules should be. And are they able, I mean, could that just go on for like the next 2 years? And I mean, is Biden going to have to just only use executive orders until they make an agreement?
Sarah, thanks for the call. Sarah pointing, Andy, toward dysfunction in Congress in real time, I guess, and whether that's going to motivate President Biden now to do more and more executive actions.
Yeah, it's a good question. Obviously, it does show the difficulty even in organizing the Senate, especially when you have legislative margins so close in the Senate and, you know, even in the House. You do you know, this is something that McConnell and Schumer will settle, because it's in both of their interests to do that and to get a power sharing agreement in place. But, you know, to the degree that it's holding up, you know, the Biden legislative program, you know, or his nominees for that matter. And of course, let's not forget there's an impeachment trial coming down the pike. You know, all of this, you know, competes for very scarce floor time, and the incentives will be for Biden to, you know, again, take a unilateral executive action route rather than wait for Congress to get its act together.
Thanks for that call. Andy, do you see a scenario in, I don't know, the next decade or two where we could see smoother functioning between a president and Congress to where the temptation to use and maybe push the envelope on executive authority is reduced?
Well, remember, executive action doesn't always have to be in a way that's hostile to Congress. It can also be used to implement congressional action. So, you know, often when you do have unified government and, you know, Congress passes a law that the president has worked towards, you know, that then needs to be implemented. And so you'll see a whole flurry of executive action in that way. So I don't think you'll necessarily see less action, even if, you know, some kind of miraculous harmony settles upon Washington, D.C. But, you know, it would be used differently in that context, right, to implement existing law rather than to sort of invent new law, you know, many years after the fact. Is that likely? You know, I think the margins are going to remain slim. And we also have an issue where there's a certain partisan loyalty in Congress that makes it difficult to enforce even, you know, Congress's prerogatives against executive abuse, right? Most, you know, Democrats and Republicans have tended to like executive action if it's done by a president of their own party. And then every 4 or 8 years, they switch hats and say, no, it's tyranny. And then the other side decides that, no, it's strong leadership. So given those incentives, which, by the way, really start, you know, at the voter level, right? They start with the incentives that they're being given by their own constituents. I don't think we're going to see very dramatic change in the short term.
Andy, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andrew Rudalevich is a professor and the chair of the Department of Government and Legal Studies at Bowdoin College. He's the author of the upcoming book, By Executive Order, Bureaucratic Management and the Limits of Presidential Power. And that's exactly what we've been talking about, what presidents can and can't do with different or can't do with different kinds of executive authority with this change in administration. Coming up after the news, how does former President Donald Trump's rise and rule in the United States compare to authoritarian leaders around the world? Our guest says it's important to evaluate the 45th president in that context. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 7:30 on The Morning Show, communities around Wisconsin are working to get people vaccinated. Find out how UW-Green Bay and a healthcare provider are working to get the job done in northeastern Wisconsin. It's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Now, our next guest says there are a lot of similarities across decades, national boundaries, and continents among authoritarian leaders over the last century. And she includes former President Trump on this list. She says learning about how they rise to power, stay in power, use, and ultimately lose power can be helpful in preventing future figures from trying to destroy democratic governments. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for our guest about the history of authoritarian leaders? Do you see former President Trump in that category? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is called Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Ruth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start out with a look at the character of Mussolini, somebody you've studied a lot. You describe him in the book as the first man to transform a democracy into a dictatorship. And you see themes that he starts pop up again and again to this day. What were some of the things you see in Mussolini that keep popping up in authoritarian strongmen ever since?
So Mussolini's you know, we always think about Hitler for good reason, but Mussolini is more appropriate to understand how things work today because he was a prime minister in a democracy for 3 years before he declared dictatorship. So during that time, and there was no template for this, he was demonizing the press. He was, you know, having leftists and other people, even leftist priests jailed and doing everything to erode democracy. And when he declared dictatorship, it was to escape a corruption investigation, which is very contemporary. That's something that we have in the news today, that Vladimir Putin is going after, you know, Alexei Navalny, who has exposed his corruption. So Mussolini had killed the socialist leader of the Socialist Party, but the guy was killed not just because he was an anti-fascist, but he was about to expose Mussolini's financial corruption. And to get out of the investigation, Mussolini declared dictatorship and shut the whole thing down.
And there are, you mentioned hostility toward the press, corruption. What are some of the other elements that you see in Mussolini coming up again and again? You highlight things like this machismo, virility almost. Can you talk about that a little as something that he established and we see again and again?
So one of the purposes of the writing the book was to look at patterns that come up over and over again. And obviously I was writing as an American who was concerned with seeing these patterns occur in our time and place. So one thing that happens is that men like Mussolini find favor when a society has gone through a lot of social transformation. Could be gender emancipation. In that case, it was after World War One. It could be racial emancipation, workers' rights. And these are processes that make some people very uncomfortable. So Mussolini came up. He had been a journalist, which is very important because he was extremely good at mass communication. And many of these men are highly skilled at manipulating the crowd, at saying and being exactly what people need them to be at that moment. And they use their bodies very effectively. So the machismo, I have a chapter on virility. And I wanted to take that seriously because it's easy to laugh where we have, Mussolini stripping his shirt off to thresh wheat, pretending to be a peasant. Or we have Putin who goes fishing with his pecs all puffed up. But it's actually part of how they, a very important part of how they present themselves to their people as a protector, as an aggressor who's going to defend the nation. So I wanted to take that seriously. And so there too, Mussolini was the first world leader to engage in manual labor with his shirt off. And he and Putin are like bookends. Now, Trump doesn't show his own body, but when he tweeted in 2019 an image directly, it wasn't even a retweet, of his head photoshopped onto Sylvester Stallone's body, which was half naked, that was in this tradition.
Talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat about her new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on authoritarian dictators, leaders, whether you worry that the United States is vulnerable to being taken over by someone in this strong man tradition. Well, Ruth, I'm going to skip over a bunch of the history in your book and tackle the present day now. Donald Trump, you can come back to again and again. You see him fitting into this strong man tradition. You've touched on a couple of the ways. Talk some more about that, please.
Yeah. So when I started writing about Trump in 2015, when I saw him holding rallies and having loyalty oaths, and then when I saw him, heard him say, I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and not lose any followers, I grew highly alarmed because this is not how democratic with a small D leaders act. This is how people act who are going to follow a different playbook. And unfortunately, Trump has a very similar temperament and personality to leaders of the past. Now, the outcome is different today. And I divide the book into three phases. There's fascist years, military coups, and today. So you don't have as many one-party states. But Trump, with his hiring and firing constantly, with his constructing a cocoon of flatterers and family members around him, which makes for bad decision-making, his incitements of aggression, his legitimation of extremism, his extreme egocentrism and impulsivity, all of this matches the personality profile of former leaders and gets translated into policy.
Now, there are people listening probably who are nodding along and agreeing. There are people listening who voted for President Trump once or twice and saying, well, wait a minute. I just wanted somebody who is going to shake up the system, some restore some of the values I want to see in American government. They wouldn't buy this this picture of him as an authoritarian, at least potentially authoritarian strongman. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I mean, and of course, what people would say to me is, because I started writing about this in 2016, or we can even stick to when he became president. Well, that's silly, because you wouldn't be able to speak out if he were authoritarian. But everybody started somewhere. And, you know, what we see now of people like Erdogan in Turkey, or who jails, you know, arrests hundreds of thousands, they started somewhere. And I really see Trump as following a different model of government. He never intended to govern in a traditional sense. And this was one of his strengths for people. They wanted somebody who would, he formed a movement. It's very important that he had a movement at the beginning, that he was going to shake up politics, that he communicated in a very different manner. All of these men have direct communications with their people, and he used Twitter. Like Mussolini and Hitler used radio and newsreels. And he spoke the language of emotion. And this really bonded people to him and made them think that he cared about them. He told them, I love you. My view is that this was a lot of manipulation. He's extremely skilled propagandist. And his goals were not those of regular governance of either party. His primary goal, which is why he spent one out of every 3 days at a Trump property, was to turn public office into a vehicle of private enrichment. That he worked very hard at visiting Trump properties on days he should have perhaps been in the White House. So I just see him as a different kind of ruler. And what happened on January 6th kind of is a logical extension of this different model of governance. Because my last chapter endings, the one thing that you know is that these men don't leave office quietly. And I had to turn in the book in the summer, and I didn't know how the election would go. But the last words I write about Trump is that he wasn't going to leave without fight. He wasn't going to go quietly.
Do you think the American system of representative government was at risk in that, especially in that period from the last election to Inauguration Day?
I don't think that the whole system was at risk, but it's very alarming if you look at that long period that opened up with him refusing to recognize the election. And it was quite notable to me that even the liberal leaders like Modi in India and Erdogan in Turkey had congratulated Biden, but Trump didn't. He wasn't going to do that. And the things he tried are straight out of the history of authoritarianism. So first he you know, he had kind of investigated some kind of military intervention. And then General Milley shut that down. So he came out of the blue with a declaration that said, we're not going to serve an individual, which is obviously Trump. We're going to serve the Constitution. And then he tried the election manipulation. And this is typical of 21st century authoritarians. Nowadays, you come to office through elections, and you must manipulate elections to stay there. And you must have an avalanche of propaganda that makes people lose faith in the trustworthiness of their elections. And he did that on every level, at every part of the voting process. He tried to make people think that this was fraudulent or just uncertain. And that didn't work. He didn't have the right people in place, as in Georgia. And so he went for something that reminded me of early fascism, summoning these paramilitaries and non-state actors, although it turns out a lot of people from military and law enforcement, and they came to rescue their leader who had been robbed of something rightfully his. And that's very fascistic. So there's a lot to be alarmed about if you see the whole period of these last months as an assault on our system of democracy.
We're talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. We're talking about her new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the history of these authoritarian strongmen from Mussolini to today? And what do you think of applying these lessons of the past to the Trump administration? Do you have worries about the future here in the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Ruth Ben-Ghiat from New York University about her new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hello.
Hi. So I would actually like to make the argument that democracy is always fragile to strong men just by its very nature, because in order to provide us with the freedoms that we cherish and hold dear, like freedom of the press, freedom of speech, so on and so forth, democracy by its very nature becomes weak to the very institutions which it is there to uphold, and almost becomes vulnerable. I think it becomes incumbent upon each and every one of us that if we value the freedoms and the blanket of freedom that we sleep under, we need to do all of our own individual parts to make sure to maintain that and support it, because it could come down at any second. And
Marcus,
so it's a...
But thanks a lot for the call, Marcus. Ruth, he points toward, I think if anyone's the hero of your book, it's the people who in all these regimes resisted early, late, and survived, for that matter. Could you talk about what Marcus is pointing to as the role of citizens here?
Yeah, that's really important. And I one of the most moving chapters after writing, because the book has a bit of grimness to it, it wasn't very fun to write at times, was the resistance chapter. To see how people have resisted in so many ways, to see how mass nonviolent protest has been so important, but also how, you know, it's true that we have taken democracy for granted in some ways, and it's something that we need to work at. We have to build democracy protection into our everyday lives, in a sense. And I think that certainly the Trump administration and January 6th have been a wake-up call, because democracy is, to some extent, is an honor system. And men like Trump are not men of honor. In fact, they have, and Berlusconi in Italy was also like this, their whole business model and life model was about inhabiting this gray zone between the illegal and the legal, and seeing what they can get away with. So one of my conclusions in the book is that legal, like this kind of macho lawlessness, is at the heart of authoritarianism. And so citizens have to, in the wake of someone like Trump, it's very important for us to push back at to have, you know, anti-corruption measures and accountability and transparency. And I think that to show by mobilizing, by being in touch with officials, that we care about these rights, that we care about officials acting with ethics in mind.
Let's go to another caller now. Nancy is with us in Managua. Nancy, hi.
Hi, I had a question. My question is that Mussolini had to be exiled in order for him to not cause problems in Italy. What then do you think is going to happen with, you know, Trump? And, you know, are we looking at him coming back? How do we get all the people that are still, you know, just constantly thinking everything he says was perfect? How do we get those people deprogrammed?
Nancy, thanks, Scott. Yeah. I remember. Oh, go ahead, Ruth.
No, go ahead.
I don't remember Mussolini being exiled. He was ultimately killed, I think. But the main point Nancy's raising, how do you make sure somebody doesn't make a comeback even after an initial defeat?
Yeah, it's hard to get them out of the system. Meaning, even if they end up killed, it's hard to get the personality cults unbelievably can carry on. And I think that it's not clear that Trump is finished. I wrote an op-ed for the LA Times about how once personality cults are created, they continue on, and Trump will carry his 70 plus million voters with him, and his cult of victimhood, which is absolutely crucial to leader cults and the success of authoritarianism. The leader is an aggressor, a protector, but he's also a victim. In our case, the deep state and prosecutors and all the usual likely suspects. So I don't think Trump's going to just fade away quietly. His ego needs and financial needs require him to continue to have some kind of public political role. So we haven't seen the last of him. I do think, to be more optimistic on this point, I think there were a number of voters who may not have loved Trump, but they were, I call them situational voters. They voted for Trump because they believed that Biden was going to mean the beginning of socialist apocalypse, ruin. And I think in 6 to 9 months, when they see that socialist apocalypse is not in fact arriving, that part of the voting public of Trump may be a little persuadable.
And Ruth, I want to take a couple minutes looking at the international connections between strongmen today. You point out that a lot of people in former President Trump's inner circle had contacts to some of the other characters in your book, from Putin to Erdogan and others. Is this an international movement in some ways?
It's very much an international movement. And one of the core things I argue is that these kinds of rulers are what's called personalist rulers. Their own personal private obsessions and needs, and including financial needs, come to influence domestic and foreign policy. And they wrap their parties around their fingers with all the loyalty quotients. And so with foreign leaders, they often privatize or personalize foreign policy. We don't know the full nature of Trump's relationship with Putin, but Berlusconi had a similar relationship with Putin in the early 2000s, and it was built on mutual financial deals that they were pursuing. The same with Erdogan of Turkey. We don't hear enough about Erdogan, who was the leader Trump talked to the most of any foreign leader. And he had William Barr as attorney general, do maneuvers to prevent the prosecution of a Turkish bank as a favor to Erdogan. So this is what I mean, this kind of this reduction or privatization almost of foreign policy. And there, what Kushner, his son-in-law, did with, Qatar, and all of this web of nebulous, nefarious, corrupt things that go on is souped up when you have a leader whose own personal well-being and financial prosperity becomes the center of governance for him.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Ruth, are you concerned that another similar figure could rise in the U.S. sooner than later?
I think that Trump's left a roadmap for sure, to, especially with election manipulation and election discrediting, that someone else could follow, getting the right people in place with a different outcome. But I also think that he's left a roadmap for us of what to do to shore up our democracy, to protect it, where the weak points are in our institutions, and the power of protest. And we can use that going forward too.
Ruth, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. We talked with her about her new book. It's called Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Biden administration has been rolling out plans for immigration, both in executive orders and in proposed laws. Find out what's changing and who it could affect. As coronavirus vaccines continue to roll out, some rural areas face unique challenges in storing, distributing, and giving the shots. Find out how local health officials are tackling those challenges. There are a lot of grown-ups who like movies made for kids, and that's okay. We'll explore the nostalgia and appeal behind children's movies, and you can join in with your own favorites. Plus, one of the most intriguing places in the solar system is deep inside one of Jupiter's moons. A science writer shares the quest for Europa. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. On Food Friday, we talked about birthday cakes and other celebration desserts. You can still find a few great recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you shared more of your favorite cakes on the Ideas Network Facebook page, plus a good story. Cassandra says she likes anything with chocolate cake, chocolate chips, and chocolate fudgy icing. Cheryl writes, the first time I ever ate coconut, it was shredded on top of a B-Day cake. I was 5. The other kids hated it, but I was hooked. Still love to see coconut on cakes. Jackie says, always pineapple upside down cake with whipped cream and vanilla custard. Pat goes for angel food with strawberries on top. Nancy says, we're not cake fans. Our wedding cake was a giant brownie, so we often have individual chocolate souffles. Okay, here's the story from Ravana. In college, Ravana writes, I made a chocolate crazy cake with a cooked fudge icing for a friend's surprise birthday. I mistimed the icing, and when it was set, it was as hard as concrete. To put the candles in, my friends and I had to drill through the icing first. Then we realized we could hold the cake plate sideways, and the cake wouldn't move since it was cemented to it. We walked into the friend's house singing happy birthday while holding the cake with lit candles sideways. Took a bit of convincing to get him to believe it was a real cake. The cake was quite delicious once you chipped the icing off, and you could suck the icing shards like hard candy. Not going to top that cake story. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.